Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff.
In this show, we're going to dive deep into flips, wholesales, holding rentals, and creatively structuring deals.
So that we can show you how you can achieve that lifestyle of freedom that you desire. Hey guys, welcome back to the Chasing Freedom Show with Noah and Jeff. Today we have an extra special guest. This is our good buddy, Tommy McGill from North Carolina, whose company is Woodward Homes. He does fix and flip, some commercial stuff. He's an awesome dude. And actually, I'm just going to be vulnerable right at the beginning. We did a future self exercise at the Maui Masterclass, and my future self looked exactly like Tommy. So someday I hope to look just like Tommy. That's my goal. Tommy, thanks for coming on, bro. We appreciate it, man.
No problem, man. I love it.
I don't know that you could ever have his jaw structure, though.
I know, dude. See, that's what it was. It was the jaw and the beard, and I was just like, I need this so bad. Well, Tommy, let's jump into your real estate journey, man. Our show is really geared towards early investors and people who kind of want to get started and scale up. So what were you doing before real estate, and what gave you that bug and got you able and willing to take the jump into full-time real estate?
So I was in architecture school. I went to a five-year architecture school program, and then about three quarters of the way through architecture school, my girlfriend actually cheated on me with this guy, and his dad was a developer, and he just had money hand over fist.
Yeah.
So I was like, hey, in an effort to not get cheated on again, let's try and do the real estate development stuff.
I love it.
This has got to be the most interesting way I've ever heard someone get started in real estate.
That's actually true, but that's not really why I got into it.
You got into it to get even with the girl, huh?
Yeah. Fuck her. So I was in architecture school. We did a professional practice class in architecture school, and they did a percentage breakdown of like who makes the profits on developments and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, 10% for the architect, 15% for the contractor. I was like, all right, 10 plus 15. I was like, all right, well, where does that other 75% go?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, well, that goes to the developer, the investor. And I was like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, I want to be that guy.
Yeah, I want to be that guy who doesn't get cheated on.
75% of the pie and not cheated on?
Yeah, so I graduated from architecture school. I worked for an architect for about 6 months. I told him like from the very beginning, like, hey, listen, I don't want to be an architect. I want to work in real estate development. So if you don't mind, you know, I will help recruit people from my architecture program to come work for you. As long as you understand that, hey, listen, I'm going to go work for a developer as soon as I get a job. Mm. He was like, cool, let's do that. So I supplied him with about three or four architects to help him with his business, and then got a job with a real estate developer in Miami. That's where I went to school. I went to school at University of Miami.
Okay.
I worked for that developer for about 2.5 years. And then I kind of had a lifelong dream to move to New York City. So when I was working in Miami, I was building like high rise, you know, 65 story towers. And then I transferred into doing like townhome communities, like 350 townhomes. And while I was doing that, I didn't really have a grasp on how like the buildings went together.
Yeah.
I kind of understood, you know, from a 10,000 foot level, like, hey, this is kind of how it works out. And then, you know, a contractor would be like, all right, well, it's going to take me 2 weeks to set this CMU block wall for this townhome cluster. And I'm like, all right. Like,
sure.
Is that true? I don't know if that's true, you know? So when I was looking in New York City, I actually looked for working for a general contractor as opposed to a developer.
Okay.
So I got a job with a general contractor in New York City about 2.5 years after I started in Miami. So moved up there, started working in construction for about 5 years. Then went to business school and got an MBA in finance. And then I was working at the time as well and doing sort of like high-end residential, like brownstones in New York City, which was really, really cool. And then as soon as I finished my MBA, I got a job with a real estate investor, a company called Hines, and worked for them for about 3 years. So the way that I looked at it when I was, the whole time I knew that I wanted to be an investor.
Yeah.
So the way that I looked at it is like, you know, my education is like this pie, right? And so when I started off with the pie, I started off with like the design side. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I need to have a concept of, you know, the design of buildings. Then the second piece was like, all right, I need to get a concept of how buildings actually go together.
Yeah.
And then the last piece was, you know, I need to understand the financial breakdown of how properties get analyzed. So I felt like the whole time I knew I was going to go out on my own, but
yeah.
I just like grinded it out for like 12 years of getting this really strong foundation of education so that I can guarantee myself not to fail, you know? Like I am like in awe of guys like you that are, you know, starting out at like I started my company at 37. I'm 41 now.
Yeah.
I don't look 41.
Like guys like you are like so fantastical to me because it's just to have that wherewithal and then be able to be successful doing it is like, it's just so impressive. Like at 25, 27, I didn't have the mental capacity to do it. You know, I just, that's really great of you guys. But anyway, so fast forward to three years into working for this company, Hines, just being surrounded by some of the most brilliant development minds in the country. You know, I learned a lot in those 3 years, probably more in those 3 years than I did in previous like 9 years. So that gave me the confidence to go forward with it. And so I was doing a live-in flip while I was working for Hines.
Okay.
And it was a 250 square foot condo in New York City in the West Village.
So it's huge.
So I did all
that's so New York. That's like the most New York thing I've ever heard somebody say.
So that was like my first flip, and I was doing it live in. So it took me about 8 months to finish the flip.
Okay.
And I live like two blocks away from not a Home Depot, but like a construction supply place.
Okay.
So I literally, you'd see me walking down the street, like holding plywood, like through the streets of New York City.
I love it, dude.
So I bought that place in 2012 and then renovated it for about 8 months. Lived in it until 2017. And then sold it, and I used the funds that I made from that in order to start my business.
Nice. What did you make on that live and flip?
So it's been my most successful flip that I've done so far. I made
$225,000. Holy, wow. What a way to start.
On a 250 square foot apartment condo?
Hold on. Yeah. What does that break down to per square foot?
Bro, that's like 87 or 90 cents 200, a square foot or something stupid.
Did you say 250 profit?
225
profit.
$225,000 profit divided by 250 square feet.
You did it backwards.
It's
okay. You're close.
225.
Bro, so okay, walk us through what that flipped looked like. So you were living there, you were doing your full time job, spending 8 months. Do you remember what you purchased that thing for and then what you put into renovation wise?
Yeah. So I mean, it was all sweat equity from the labor side.
Yeah.
And then because I was working in construction, like my plumber that I was doing like these, you know, renovations, he was like, oh, we have this like stainless steel undermount sink with a dent in it. Do you want it? And I'm like, I do want it. And then it was like another person was like, hey, you know, like this faucet doesn't fit with this like multi-million dollar, you know, townhome.
Yeah.
Do you want it? And it's like, of course I want it.
So yeah.
I really kind of like, you know, it was like a scrounge, I don't know, like a
You scrapped this thing together, dude.
Like, some of the stuff like barely matched, you know, but it still was really nice. But let's see, let me do the math. I think I purchased it for $250.
That's crazy.
And put in about 15,000.
Think about like, what is that? That's like $1,000 a square foot, right? Yeah. $1,000 a square foot, 250 times 1,000 is 250 grand.
Yeah. And then I sold it for 272.5.
Okay.
So the equity that I put into it, so I guess it wasn't 225. Maybe it was, that's the check that I got. So it was probably a little less than that. It might've been like 200.
Yeah.
Still, it was, you know, pretty decent.
Yeah, that's incredible. Okay, so then that's the seed money for your business. So like, it's like, hey, boom, made the check. Heinz, goodbye. I'm out doing my own thing. Or what'd that process look like? And then what was your next step? What'd you buy next and start doing?
Yeah, so I went to the senior managing director and said, hey, I'm going to move to Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm going to start a flipping business. This is my 2 weeks notice. Well, I worked in asset management at the time, and he was like, well, we're going to purchase this building. Do you mind waiting? And I'm like, and I loved working there. So I was like, yeah, no problem. So 2 weeks notice turned into 2 months notice. So it took about 2 months, but yeah. So I picked up all my shit, piled it in, you know, my brother's pickup truck and drove back down to Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah.
I didn't really know 100% what I wanted to do. I knew I needed to flip houses because I needed some level of income.
Mm.
So what I did instead of starting, I did like a cross country tour. And this is actually when I went to Idaho.
Okay.
And it was kind of like a find yourself tour, kind of figure out like, you know, what your life is always or going to be about.
Yeah.
And I read the book, The One Thing. And that's like really what kind of changed me in, you know, how to approach things and, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, eventually I made it. I went up across the top of the US, down the PCH, and then across the bottom, and found myself through a lot of alcohol consumption.
I was going to say, I was surprised you made it back from the West Coast, honestly, just like kind of knowing Tommy's vibes. Like, I just feel like you went down PCH, you're going to get stuck somewhere, dude. Just be like, yeah, I'm going to set up here in San Diego. Just call it good.
Yeah. Well, I actually know where I set up was Portland, Oregon.
I lived there for 6 years.
Yeah. I'd never been there, and it was like the biggest surprise place that I'd ever been. So I just posted up there for 7 days. A buddy of mine moved out there to start a tire company. So I hung out with him and just, it was awesome.
Nice.
But eventually I made it back to Charlotte and started flipping houses. The first deal that I did, it was self-funded, and, you know, like I bought it for $76,000, put about 35 into it and sold it for $149.9.
Nice.
So that was the first deal.
When you say self-funded, you bought it with the cash from your first flip. Is that correct?
That's correct. Nice. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah. I did probably 30% of the work.
Okay.
I hired a contractor, but I wasn't, you know, it was my first deal. So I wasn't 100%, you know, trustworthy of him.
Yeah.
So I wanted to like kind of keep an eye on him.
Mm-hmm.
So I did some of the work myself so that I could just keep an eye on him.
That makes sense. And then did you have your realtor's license at the time?
Not at the time, but okay. Like I sold that one. A friend of mine helped me sell it, or a friend of a friend of mine helped me sell it. And like I said, all right, well, you know, I'll give you 2% and then you can just take 2% of any future deals. And like she bitched and moaned about the 2%. And I'm like, you're literally not going to have to advertise for me at all.
Yeah.
My goal is to do 10 deals a year. Like, you're getting 10 free deals a year.
That's shocking.
She complained the whole time. So I was like, all right, fuck you. I'm getting my license myself. And I'm like,
yeah.
I'm going to, you know, so that was the last deal that I sold with the realtor. I went and got my license and then just sold everything else myself.
Okay. And this deal, just time frame wise, this was what, about 2-3 years ago, somewhere in there? Four, maybe?
No, that was four years ago.
Okay, four. Okay, cool. Yeah.
One of the things I was kind of shocked to hear you say is that you did 30% of the work yourself, because at the beginning of this episode, you talked a lot about how long you educated yourself for. I mean, mm-hmm. you went from working with a developer to a GC, then you got your background in, you know, finance with your MBA and all these things. So I was surprised to hear you say that you had done 30% of the work yourself, but do you think that was solely a fear-based decision because you didn't want that GC to take advantage of you?
100%. Yeah. Completely fear-based. Yeah. When I got used to him on that first deal, he did probably four more deals for me. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I let him go, you know, run wild with it. I mean, there are definitely times where for like in the first year or so that I spent too much time on the job sites, whether it be delivering materials or, you know, firing a contractor and being like, all right, well, I'm going to install this backsplash myself.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely been a lot more of that, but I was caught in the mindset of like January 1st to December 31st. Like my goal was like, I wanted to make $200,000. Mm. So like I was stuck in that mindset of like an income based mindset,
yeah,
as opposed to a net worth based mindset. Mm. So when I shifted from income to net worth, like if I had to fire somebody, I would just wait until somebody else came back in there, you know?
Yeah.
And instead of doing it myself, because, you know, obviously your time is worth more than what you're going to pay some guy $25 an hour to do.
Yeah.
Can I pick your brain on what helped you?
Only questions.
only simple questions.
Like no hard questions. I give you no info today, bud.
I just want to pick your brain on what helped you shift your mindset from like an income based, like making income based decisions to making net worth based decisions. And why is that important? Why was that necessary? I mean, I think I have a decent understanding of it, but for anyone listening, why was that important for you to do that?
I guess it came down to like writing really large checks to the IRS.
Yeah.
You know? It was like, this sucks, you know?
Yeah.
I don't really like doing that at all. And it's funny because the second that I made that shift, it, like the income came, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of other things, like I started to partner with a builder on things just so I didn't have to hire contractors anymore. Like he would be the GC and then he would sub out everything to subcontractors. So like, so that happened at the same time I made that shift. Mm. And I just, the biggest part was just, you know, I had done all this work, but I had really nothing to show for it,
yeah.
You know? And I don't mean that in like a dig on anybody who like flips houses. It's just like, you know, I, you know, spent 3 years and I basically just made the shift this past year. You know, I just kept going and going and going and didn't really have a lot to show for it from a, like if somebody were to offer me, you know, money to buy my company, they would be buying nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I picked up a couple rentals along the way, but nothing substantial.
Mm. And when you say you had nothing to show for it, what I'm assuming is like you had money in the bank, but you have to continue spinning that hamster wheel to keep bringing more money in, to keep funding more projects and keep paying for things.
Right. Right.
So, AJ Osborne actually gave a really good analogy to me one time in relation to this. He used to run insurance companies. He made boatloads mm-hmm. of money, right? He related this to a Ferrari. The Ferrari can go really fast, but you burn through your fuel so quickly that on a long road trip, you're not likely to even get to where you're going unless you stop and fill up for gas. And then it's expensive to do all the oil changes and maintenance, mm-hmm. right? So the Ferrari is a different type of wealth vehicle. It's not really wealth. It's just high income.
Yeah.
And that's what right. a flip business is until you start to buy and hold assets
yep.
or you start to worry about your net worth. And AJ right. relates this to, I actually forget what he relates this to, but it's a different type of wealth vehicle. It's something that actually builds and grows with time. and holds its value, right? So that's the cash flow. That's something that continue to keep bringing in income. I guess I would relate that to like maybe buying cars and then renting them out on Turo, right? Now, now instead of the vehicle just costing you a lot of money and going really fast, these cars actually bring in income. They're building up your bank account. So it's kind of an interesting thought process. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. So then I kind of had that mind shift and went into, you know, I do need to make some level of income, I feel. So I try and show, you know, 4 or 5 flips a year minimum.
Yeah.
And then I basically try and hold on to as much as I can.
Yeah.
The only reason I would sell is that if something's, so Charlotte is located like 30 minutes from the border to South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually do some investing in South Carolina. And I don't typically, because their tax situation, I don't typically hold as much down there. So if I find a deal in South Carolina, I'll usually sell that.
Gotcha. Okay. And the rentals that you're holding on to, are those, are you using the BRRRR method to get those?
Yes. Some of it BRRRR, some of it, you know, buy and holds with, you know, minimal. I mean, I guess essentially it is the BRRRR method because, you know, I am refinancing the money out.
Yeah.
And I do, it's the BRRRR method with the R renovation, like very low.
Okay.
So it's like,
just not a big rehab.
I can give you a deal example if you want.
Yeah. That'd be great if you could walk us through one of those. I think that's really helpful. That's one of the things that, not that it's a new fad, people have been doing it forever, but David Green slaps the name BRRRR on it now. Like, that's the hot topic. Everyone's like, how can I get rentals for free? Like, so
right.
Yeah, walk us through some numbers on some of those.
So of March of this year, I bought 10 single family homes for $600,000.
So a portfolio,
which is around tax value.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, that equates to about $60,000 per home.
Yep.
The homes were built in the 90s by the guy who actually lived in one of the properties. So they were all in really good shape, and he took care of them. So everything was in great shape. So there wasn't a lot to do, but you know, one of the homes was, vacant when I purchased it. So, I wanted to do some lipstick stuff to increase the rent. So we put like LVP floors in there,
okay,
and just painted, and you know, increased the rent by $100.
Yeah.
So that costs all of about, you know, $2,000 or $3,000, and then we replaced some water heaters, and you know, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So then, you know, I was like, all right, well, I bought it with private money, so I need to refinance my investor money out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, contacted the bank, refinanced out. We haven't received the appraisal back yet, but we did like a pencil appraisal from another bank. They basically went in and, you know, did it sort of digitally.
Yeah.
And it appraised for around $1.7 million.
Good numbers.
The package, right?
1 million of equity creation.
Yeah.
Just from, you know, getting a good deal.
Yeah.
And the guy who sold us the property is like 82 years old. He just wanted enough money to take care of himself and his wife. Mm. And you know, it's just a good deal. So it's still the BRRRR method, but it's, you know, it's, the R is just a little bit smaller.
Yeah. I think that's actually, it brings up a good point, because what I find when I talk to a lot of people about the BRRRR is that they assume that it has to be some crazy big renovation to create that large equity. But there's two ways really to create equity that then you can use for the refinance, right? You can do the renovation and do forced appreciation, right? Or you can buy a freaking good deal that has built-in equity from day one. And so what you did, you didn't have a huge renovation, but you negotiated a really good deal that had built-in equity. So then when you did the little bit of renovation to it, you were still able to use that BRRRR model to pull out your investor cash. Because those are killer numbers. You bought for 6 and spent what overall, like maybe between the 10 units, like 60, 70 grand?
Much less.
Wow.
That's crazy. So like then
probably 15 And that's only because we had to buy a new lawnmower to cut the grass.
What kind of lawnmower you buy, bro? 2G lawnmower? You got the little rider?
John Deere, man. It's 5 acres.
That's hilarious.
Tommy's like, I bought the nice one that has the beer koozie, and I'm the guy who actually goes and mows the lawns every Saturday.
That's my chair on the lawnmower.
It's actually a funny story. One of the guys who lives in the one of the houses was mowing the lawn for the previous owner. So we negotiated. So we went out to probably 4 or 5 lawn service companies, and they're like, it's going to be $1,000 a month. I mean, I think it's 5+ acres.
Okay.
And we're like, man, this is terrible. So that's going to eat up our cash flow. So the guy who was mowing it before, he's like, I'll do it for $400 a month. And we're like, yes, you will.
Yeah. That works.
He started off at 5. And I think we got him down to 4, but then we also increased his rent to like offset some things. But so he does it for 400 and he does an incredible job. He actually enjoys doing it. So
that's rad.
That helps with the cash flow for sure.
Yeah. So on that unit, so you said it appraised at 1.4?
1.7.
Jeez.
What's your cash flow right now? Because do you have hard money on it right now, or did you buy it cash?
So I use some of my money and then some of 2 private investors that get 8% on their money. So that 8% only happens at closing.
Oh, nice.
Or not only happens, but it happens at closing.
Yeah.
Hey, so if you guys are my private money investors listening, you should be grateful for how much we pay you compared to how much time. No, I'm just kidding. I'm totally kidding. You got good deals with your private money.
Yeah, all the
guys.
3 people that are listening to you.
Like, well, it's my mom, it's my grandpa, no, it's his parents.
It's 1, 2,
mom,
and 3.
Mom, yeah. If you...
Hey, look, our podcast guy said that we actually get really good listens for being a young podcast. So it's all right. It's cool.
Yeah. No,
all right. So let's track through that. So when you refi that out, what's your goal? Are you trying to get a large cash out portion and roll that into other investments? Or you want to keep that LTV pretty low and have more cash flow?
I want to keep the LTV low and have more cash flow.
Okay.
I think that because we're in a situation right now as investors that you can get money fairly cheap.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly can't get it for 3.85, which I think is our interest rate.
Yeah.
So I was caught in that quandary of like, do I take more money out and essentially use it to reinvest into other things?
Yeah.
And I opted for more cash flow. And I think I did that more so out of fear than anything.
Yeah.
Because I think honestly the smart play would have been to take it out and then use it. But because actually I'm doing 7 new builds right now, and I could have paid for those new builds, but paying 3.85% on $1 million from the get-go without having any cash flow coming in to take care of it. I just was a little worried about that.
Mm.
So we're going to use a similar bank to get us financing that's pretty close to 4%. So, it's probably going to work out. Well, I was just nervous. I guess it was a fear-based decision because I didn't want to pay interest on the $1.1 million or whatever it ended up being.
Yeah. Well, and you want that asset to be able to stand alone, right? Like, so if you were to then go and take 75% or 80% LTV and it doesn't cash flow, well, then that's not the best decision. So, like, sure, there may have been a portion that was fear-based, but I'm a firm believer that I want all of my assets to – like, I don't want to be like, oh, I have a successful portfolio, but these 20 properties on their own, they suck. They don't cash flow because I did max LTV. That's not a good investment because what if those are in a different market and that market shifts and now all of a sudden you're underwater on those and you're not cash flowing on it? So I think there's the give and take. And so protecting your investment, making sure it has good cash flow. And who's to say you can't go and pull a HELOC out on that in the future if you decide to go and do something else with it? So
yeah, it's true. It's just I guess it's more of like a personal preference because I met with Josh Blankenship.
Yeah.
I know that you guys had on the podcast, and he actually leveraged one of his deals, I think it was a 6-unit, into essentially growing like 120-150 unit portfolio. Mm-hmm. But he used that first unit to leverage like the next, you know, down payment, yeah, to, yeah, leverage the next down payment. And, you know, he ended up selling that one at a loss, but he grew a portfolio that was, you know, like, you know, pretty significant. So I guess it's really just personal preference, but I just feel at the moment we're in right now, you can still get pretty cheap money. And so that was kind of like the direction that I went in.
Hey, I actually want to dig in a little bit more on this. I like where this is going, and I want more perspective from you because of your financial education and your background in this area. So it's very interesting. So you could have pulled out the equity, right? Like from, or you could pull out the equity from this, like we're talking about, and you'd have a bigger loan, which means your cash flow would be less. That money would be tax free, right? But your risk would be
That's correct.
Yeah.
Break it down for us. Like, I mean, I guess one of my perspectives would be like, yeah, you could have pulled that money out, but unless you had a good project to put it to work in, you are better off leaving it in there. And yeah, then I guess too, like, would your loan terms have been different? Would you have had different options if you could have put down more cash with your new builds? I mean, how else could this scenario have turned out with you pulling out that cash?
I mean, I guess I could have, you know, it's tax-free and I could have just put it into the 7 new builds. Mm-hmm. But like Jeff said, I my mindset was I wanted that project to stand alone.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, maybe looking back in a year from now, I'll kick myself, but you know, I am where I am. I made the decision, yeah, and I'm just going to move forward with it.
You just have the education on it. So that's why I was just more curious to hear more.
Yeah. We're in a very similar situation. We have an 11 unit that we just finished, and we're looking at refinancing it, and we're going, okay, do we want to get a low LTV to have better cash flow, or what do we want to do? And ultimately, we came to the goal that we're going to pull the highest LTV that we can get, which is, it's only 75% loan to value. But it's because we also have the necessity to buy about another $2 million worth of real estate this year for holding to then depreciate and allow us to have less tax burden. So it was a strategic decision on the tax side for us. We definitely both liked the cash flow that it would have been at the lower LTV. So I get your wavelength. And then one day I went home and I was like, let me do like a crazy spreadsheet, because I kind of like spreadsheets. Nothing fancy though, I'm like a simple guy. But so I went and did the spreadsheet and I was like, well, I guess if we do pull this equity out and we roll it into something else, well, here's the increased cash flow from that new asset, and that cash flow plus this cash flow is bigger than just this cash flow with the low LTV. And so that's why we made the decision. But again, I think we probably would have opted for the earlier option of the low LTV if our tax strategist had not been like, you guys are going to pay a butt ton of taxes if you don't go get another $2 million asset this year. So it was like it was like a dual motivation, right? Because like you mentioned earlier, that's the worst part about being mostly a flip business is you get to the end of the year and you're like, I got to pay what in taxes? This is horrible. Yeah, yeah. So luckily now we've had a lot of guys, Josh actually, speaking of Josh, he at the mastermind was like, Jeff, you guys got to hold more. And he just like, he would just walk up to me and be like, stop flipping houses in my ear. Yeah. Hold everything. Yeah. And I was like, dude, all right, I get it. Okay. But then you go and you look at it and you meet with people who know more than you do. And you're like, yeah, it makes sense. Like, flips are awesome. We still, our goal is to flip a bunch of houses, create revenue, and shell it into rentals, and then not pay taxes. Mm. So
yeah,
it seems like you're kind of in the same thing. So Tommy,
very, very same boat.
I wanted to, before we run out of time, I saw that you spent a lot of time on your vision board and kind of looking at what the future of Woodward Homes looks like. Walk us through, and you don't have to share everything, but walk us through some of the big things, some big goals you have, some big desires of your company and then you personally, what you want to do in this world.
So the goal is really just like a number. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do 100. Right.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, I could do 100. I know I could do 100. So then I was like, all right, well maybe 300. And I'm like, ooh, 300 makes me kind of nervous.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, well, that's the number then, because 200 didn't make me as nervous as 300 did. So that's real. And, you know, I'm a single family homes, investor.
Yeah.
Most of my stuff now is getting, so I do new builds, but I do new builds with the sense of I'm going to do cash out refis on those as well.
Okay.
So the goal is just to build the portfolio. Mm. So the 300 homes is just the, it's the first number that made me really nervous.
I like that.
Yeah. So I felt on the trajectory that I'm currently at, I could do 100 easily. You know, it's right now this year I'm at like 27 homes so far.
Yeah.
And it's like, I could push it to 33 mm-hmm. easily.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's just it's a numbers game at that point.
Yeah. And you're talking 300 homes in 3 years, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. That's correct. The whole like thing that goes around that is really, when I started 4 years ago, it was like, I want to make money, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I didn't realize at the time, or even when I had the idea of being an investor, it's not for the money, it's for the freedom.
Yeah.
Like, it provides such a different lifestyle than, like, you guys, you know, I don't know what your W-2 employment like lives look like, but there were definitely days zero. Yeah, you're lucky son of a bitch. But there were definitely days where I would sit, like, I'm at a standing desk, so I can't really show you, but
I would
wake up in the morning. And like, I would put my hands on my sink and look at myself in the mirror. And I'm like, man, I want to rip this sink out of the wall and beat myself with it.
Yeah.
Instead of going to work today. It just, there's so much bullshit that happens in W-2 jobs that wears on your soul. So you don't really realize when you're going out yourself that you're not doing it for the money.
No.
Because when I worked in New York, I was making significantly more money than when I first started, right? And even for the first couple of years.
Yeah.
So it's not a money thing. It's a freedom thing.
Yeah.
Because there are times when you're like, I don't want to go to work in the morning today. I'd rather go for a run, or, you know, so everything around my vision was really based on freedom.
Yeah.
And then creating freedom, not only for myself, but then, you know, people that work for me. So that was really the mindset. So I just, you know, I packed up my stuff one day, I went into the woods and I just started writing, and I just was filling up page after page after page. And this is after building like an outline of the book Vivid Vision.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to have some level of framework to, you know, extrapolate from or expound on or whatever you want to call it. And so I just started writing, and then these great ideas started coming to mind. Like, I want to build this culture, and, you know, I know that's like a catchphrase, but I wanted to build this culture where it was based on fun. And one of the things that I learned from the Maori masterclass is like listening to guys like Tarl, who like loves like joking around and having a good time. Up until I heard him say that, I was building a company that I was like recreating that W-2 job for me, you know, where it's like, I don't want to be a slave to like seriousness and like structure and all this stuff that I like literally just got away from.
Yep.
So a lot of my Vivid Vision was creating this culture that like embodied what I believe in. And it's like, you know, they say like the 80-20 rules, you know, like spend 20% of the time that generates 80% of your value or revenue or whatever. I think it's 80, like 80% of the time I'll be serious, but 20% of the time all I want to do is fuck around with people.
Yeah.
And like, I want to build a business that's based on that, you know? So I'm not always just like living in this tunnel of like seriousness. And so that was a lot of it too. So that like sort of was like, I want to build a business that I want to work in every single day.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. So that's what my Vivid Vision, it's the 300 is just a scary number to me, but the real core of it is building a business that I want to work in and surrounding myself with people who want to work in the same business.
Yeah.
I think that's the best part of freedom and building a company, right? Is like in a W-2 job, some of the things that make it the most stressful is you don't get to make the decisions on who comes onto the team, on who you have to report to, on who reports to you, right? That decision is made by someone else.
Yep.
But when it's your company, you fill it with people that you think are a good fit. And so like I love that. I love that you shared this perspective. Like that was one of the first things that Jeff and I did is we created core values.
Yeah.
And this is not our original idea. This is from Traction. But it talked about you hire based off your core values not based off of how you feel on any given day or feel in the interview or how that, yep. if that person made you smile or whatever. No, they have to fit the company core values. One of our core values is actually have fun.
Yeah.
So,
That's mine. Yeah. That was the one that I brought. I had loyalty on there and I dropped loyalty and added fun because, yeah. you know, like I understand that people come and go mm-hmm. and like, I understand that, you know, when you work for me, I want you to be there. And if you find something else that you think that you can be more successful at, God bless you.
Yeah.
Go and do it.
I don't want to hold on to people that don't want to be there
like,
anymore.
Put my hooks in you. And yeah. I remember quitting a job to go and get my MBA. The owner of the company just refused to speak to me. He was so upset.
Really?
That he would not even talk to me. So like, yeah. So I don't, you know, I would appreciate loyalty.
Yeah.
It's not a core value. Fun to me is more important than being loyal to the company because at the end of the day, it's not their baby.
No.
You know? So it's not like, you know, if they want to go and do something else, like that's I'll support that.
Yep,
yeah.
I agree.
I've been pretty mind blown. I think we added have fun there. And then I think like almost in our heads, like we didn't make a list of like what was most important. Like they're all kind of equal. But in our heads, at least in mine, like have fun definitely ranks very close to the top of that. Yeah. And so the team that we built totally fits that. And like yesterday, I actually had this thought because I'm like, I hope no one's getting mad because me and Jake is our in-house agent. We played like 4 games of ping pong in a row. I'm like, I hope nobody's like, dude, do some work. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, we've had one of our most productive months as far as like flips being on schedule, properties being acquired, and we've done it all while playing ping pong and having fun and having this great, awesome company culture. Like we have breakfast together, lunch together, we work out. Like it is awesome. And at the same time, like the company is growing and doing, I think our month last month was one of our best months we've ever had. And we did it all while still having fun. And no one was like, this is stressful. I hate my life. Because I've been there before too. We're like, you feel like I'm going to build a business. I'm going to grind. You're like, I'm working 60, 80 hour weeks and I hate life. And then you look at the production, you're like, it doesn't even match up with the work I was putting in.
Exactly. So, exactly. Yeah.
I think it's killer, man. I love it, man. Tommy.
What are your guys' core values?
Oh, we're going to get put on the spot and see if we know them. We got ownership, add value, have fun. Did I say ownership already?
Yeah, teamwork.
Yeah.
Yep, teamwork, integrity.
Solutions-oriented.
Solutions-oriented. And then the seventh one always gets me because we went with seven. There's so many.
I thought that you're only supposed to have three.
That we tried three and then it was too hard. And I think we should have landed on five because the seventh, obviously it eludes us. It's not extremely important.
Wait.
But the other six are pretty important.
Teamwork, ownership, solutions oriented, add value, have fun.
Integrity. We'll delete whatever the other one is. It's painted on a mural at the office and it's getting deleted right after this podcast.
It's like the seven dwarves.
It's like, I mean, it looks really good on a mural, though. It fills up the wall really well.
Now I need to know.
We don't have enough time to look it up.
All
right, Tommy, we're going to wrap up the show with a couple questions we always ask. What podcasts or books did you get a ton of value from as you were learning about real estate, or what are you reading now that you'd love to share with the listeners?
I mean, obviously, I get a lot from Bigger Pockets. It's like my number one podcast. I listen to that more than anything else. The books that changed my like life were the one thing is probably, you know, the most impactful book. Traction's another impactful book. I run my company through Traction as you guys do. And then the founder of the last company that I left, his autobiography or biography is I think it's called Raising the Bar.
Okay.
Let me just see. I have it right here. But it's just like, you know, he's like a different type of guy than me. You know, he's Raising the Bar.
Yeah.
It's Gerald Hines.
Okay.
He's a different type of guy than me, and like, you know, you just want to. It's like you surround yourself with the five people, and you're the sixth that's going to be successful. But. You know, like you also have to be yourself.
Yeah.
And so you kind of get into the doldrums of a book and you're like, yeah, I want to do that. Yeah, I want to do that. And like I remember stories of him like flying in his private jet and he would only eat the homegrown potatoes that he brought with him. And I'm like, that's just not me. Like, that's not something I'm going to do.
Yeah. Know?
I'll grab like a protein bar from the newspaper stand or whatever. But yeah, so it's like, I think it's a great book, and it's like emblematic of like a great company and how they got there. But you know, their core is like, you know, they're very integrity based, and that's one of my core values as well. But
yeah,
certainly the one thing, traction, and then raising the bar.
I like all of those, man. Well, brother, we really appreciate you coming on, man. By the way, I found out the last core value, it was growth.
Growth.
Yeah. Because it's both personal, right? Like reading and growing yourself, but then also mm-hmm. always focused on growing the business. All right. That was going to bother me if I didn't share that.
I'm going to delete it today. I know the white page set paint over.
Dude, we really appreciate you coming on and making time for the show, man. And I think that a lot of people will gain a lot from what you've shared, especially in relation to how long and how patient you were with educating yourself. Yeah. I think a lot of people try to rush into stuff, and that's where they fail. Yep. And you took the time to educate yourself. So I really appreciated that perspective. How do people get a hold of you, brother?
They can go through my website, I guess.
Okay, cool.
Which is Woodward Homes Buys Houses, or yeah, that's it. Or just woodwardhomes.com, woodwardhomesllc.com.
I was hoping you'd mess up on your website, because then it'll alleviate some of the stress of missing our seventh core value.
It's growth, Jeff. It's growth.
Oh, man. I'm trying to grow the beard to fit that value, but it's not working.
Do you like the gray in here?
Dude,
what you saw in your future
self? Dude, I'm telling you, bro, my future self looked just like Tommy, and it got a little weird in my head for a second, all right? We're moving on, though. Tommy, we appreciate you. Thanks so much for jumping on with us today, man.
See you, brother.
I really appreciate it.
Boom.
All right, guys, thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff.
Please subscribe to our YouTube channel in the show notes below. And if you ever want to get a hold of us, feel free to do it via our Instagrams. You can also follow us for our funny content on TikTok.